Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. This is the Apparatus Architects with hosts Tom Shand and Michael Wilbur. And this month we're going to look at some more wrecks that we've had coming up just in the last couple days. One was this week where seatbelts saved the crew's life. And if you do have any questions for the hosts, please send an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Good morning and welcome, Mike, and welcome, Tom.
Thanks very much, Pete. Mike and Tom are live, and we're actually broadcasting together today, which is kind of neat as compared to doing it from our respective home locations. Our rundown this week, we're going to, as Peter mentioned, going to talk about some recent accidents and incidents. Couple days ago, there was a major announcement by American LaFrance, and we're going to review and comment what that means to some listeners. Going to amplify a little bit more on the most recent article that we did in the Apparatus Architect series that appeared in the April issue of Firehouse Magazine, talking about program pumpers and how that might be advantageous for your department to take a look at one of those products. And then we're going to finish up and wrap up the show with a one or two questions from our listeners. So, Brother Mike, it seems like once again the number of accidents we've had out there are getting to be not only more numerous but a little bit more serious. We've had several rig-on-rig accidents here. So what's your take on what's going on out there?
Thanks, Brother Tom. And yes, there has just been a Madrid of fire trucks running into fire trucks over the last 6 months, and especially just the last month in and of itself. The first is in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. Officials say 9 firefighters were taken to a hospital after 2 Philadelphia fire trucks collided in Center City. One was a snorkel squirt, and the other was a tractor-drawn aerial. It happened at about 11:30 in the morning. They were reportedly, and it's always strikes me kind of funny, Tom, when you get press releases of some of these accidents, and the ladder and the engine were racing to a report of a fire a few blocks from the crash scene. The two vehicles tried to take evasive action to avoid each other, but they ran into each other and ended up into a lamppost and on a sidewalk in front of a building. Pretty interesting. We move on now. An update. Yes, Tom.
Mike, just comment there. It seems like there's probably not any more of these apparatus-on-apparatus intersection accidents that there maybe were in the past, but it certainly seems two things strike me. One is that the severity of them is pretty dramatic, and I know one of the ones you're going to be covering shortly about Houston will certainly amplify that. And the other thing, it seems like several of the more common things that we could do by just, like, stopping at stop sign or signal-controlled intersections would alleviate part of this. And there's been, as well, maybe not that it's applicable in the case certainly in Philadelphia, but of technology that was developed back in the late 60s with traffic control devices that could be installed at intersections and on apparatus so that even if you're approaching a four-way intersection with an Opticom or one of the other devices that are commercially available, that one apparatus calls for the right-of-way, it gets acknowledged because they get the green light, and it would solve a lot of these things. I begin to wonder, with particularly the way the economy is, that some of these technologies, which maybe even people thought about, are now so far on the back burner, it's ridiculous. But it does make me wonder how many more of these tragic incidents we're going to have before somebody finally wakes up and says, if we can't change the human element here to get people to slow down, to go to your comment about the racing to the scene of the incident, if we can't get people to slow down, if we can't get people to tap the brakes, downshift, do whatever they have to do to come to a stop at these intersections, then maybe the technology part needs to take over here, because it doesn't seem like we're doing a good job in changing the attitude of the human element with respect to driving safety.
Yeah, that's a good point, Tom. And in an incident we're going to be covering shortly, the intersection was actually controlled by a preemption system, and it didn't matter anyway. Another update from the state of Massachusetts. We've been following for a long time now the rollover of the Providencetown Cape Cod ladder. It was recently released that the driver will retain his EMT certs that we're monitoring whether he's going to retain his EMT certification after his rollover. The cops have accused the driver of the wreck, driving under the influence of alcohol. He also faces criminal charges of driving to endanger the public, and he's also been cited for speeding and failure to slow at an intersection. The firefighter's a certified EMT, and state records indicate that certification is up for recertification, and it's not clear if he's going to be recertified. And it also goes on to say that the driver could lose his driving license, and that loss would prevent him from qualifying for his EMT job. He's currently on unpaid administrative leaves, and the town was voting earlier this month to approve spending another $300,000 to add it to the insurance check of $350,000 to purchase a new replacement vehicle. We'll have more and continue to follow this story in the weeks and months ahead. Virginia firefighter charged in a rollover crash during training. Six Virginia firefighters were injured in a crash involving their fire truck this morning around 8 a.m. They were reported to be out doing driver training. The apparatus encountered a slight curve in the road. The rig slipped off the pavement and hit a tree. It then went down an embankment and rolled several times. One of the firefighters were flown by air from the scene. The other firefighters were also injured, but the extent of their injuries is not yet known. The apparatus driver was charged by the Virginia State Police with failure to maintain control of his vehicle, reckless driving, and a failure to wear a seatbelt. Speed was reported not to be a factor in this crash, according to the state police. Interesting about this and many other wrecks, you can see them on our website at emergencyvehiclerespondse.com. We have that wreck and now many other wrecks with pictures and accounts of those. In Pennsylvania department, in two crashes in one day, a woman was injured when the vehicle she was driving and a fire truck crashed together in German Township on Sunday morning. The unidentified female was taken to a hospital. The crash, according to officials, occurred as firefighters from the fire department were on their way to a structural fire in the township. They were notified of a structural fire at 1:58 in the morning. The official said that the building, a former personal care home that had been reported to be vacant for several years, was destroyed in the blaze. So we had a working fire. As firefighters were traveling to that call, responding, the fire truck they were traveling in a car driven by the woman crashed a short distance from the firehouse, so they didn't make it there. Two other fire departments were called to assist state police at the scene of the wreck, noting that numerous other county fire departments had to handle the fire. And that brings up an interesting point, doesn't it, Tom, about resources and allocation of resources and the fact that we had a working fire here and we didn't get there.
You know, we've talked, I think, Mike, at length about driving, you know, with as you have spoken in the past about driving with due regard and having a sense of urgency, but a controlled sense of urgency in that, as was amplified in this particular instance, if you don't get there, you're not doing anybody any good. I'm just kind of surmising here. You look at the last two incidents you mentioned. Here's one where the driver is cited for a host of imprudent actions while he's out driver training. and they get the rig off the road and they roll it. And you would think to yourself, you know, if somebody not affiliated with the fire service begins to look at the actions surrounding what happens when we get involved in one of these incidents, you might be able to excuse or somehow tacitly understand what happens if you get involved in an accident as the adrenaline is flowing and you're going to the actual scene of an emergency. And again, to our listeners in the past, we've spoken about what the legal definition of a true emergency is as compared to what we think an emergency might be when our station gets toned out to respond to a CO detector alarm. So here you have two almost diametrically opposed incidents, one where, you know, we hurt some folks and we certainly do some major damage to the apparatus while we're training to become a driver to get a little better. And here's another incident where you do some major league damage as you're responding to the alarm, and then you just make the whole incident worse because now we've got another whole scenario and incident that the fire department or somebody else has to deal with, some other emergency service organization has to deal with while the fire continues to go on. And then after that gets knocked down and people find out what happens, you then go back to the station to find out that one of your rigs is damaged, if not worse. And that's not the least of the issues, because now you're dealing with the personal injury that was inflicted upon the folks as well. It just it boggles my mind, Mike, that these things, as we record these on a monthly basis, that the scenarios seem to me to be more disturbing. They're not just black and white, cut and dry. You know, somebody did something a little bit foolish, and the rig got a little squirrely, and the next thing you know, we're in trouble. It's like, I mean, we're doing some major league damage here. And to our listeners, you know, if we could appeal to your good senses to think about, to be, as we've spoken, I think in the last two podcasts, about operating in a safe and sane manner. And if you don't have a good definition of what safe and sane is by now, maybe you need to go out and get some other professional definitions and advice on that, because we're beginning to, I think, lose some credibility with all of the work that we've done to try to improve the firefighters' safety from a very practical position, is that we're designing well-equipped, safe apparatus. But if we don't operate that apparatus in a safe and sane manner, everything you've done up to that point really doesn't do you any good.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for those comments. And like you said, these incidents are just occurring with frightening regularity, and they just seem to be getting more severe with each passing day. Again, in that same town, after that crash going to the working fire, less than 24 hours later, that same fire department was involved in yet another less serious crash with their apparatus. We move on now to an ambulance in the state of Virginia involved in an intersection collision. There was no patient in the back of the ambulance, thank goodness. Everybody survived because they had seatbelts on. In the state of Colorado, an SUV slammed into the back of an engine company. A woman and a 12-year-old girl in critical condition after their sports utility vehicle slammed directly into an engine on U.S. Highway 285. Firefighters were responding to a car crash on 285. Firefighters had positioned the engine to block, as we all should do, to protect the first responders operating at the scene of this vehicle wreck, when a blue SUV drove full speed right into the back of the truck. Investigators believe that steam from melting snow on the road was so thick that the driver of the SUV may not have even seen the engine on the right lane that was blocking. No firefighters were injured, but a 12-year-old girl and the woman were airlifted in critical condition. Melting snow. I think that's a first for me. Steam from melting snow.
Well, that's maybe what it means, Mike. Occasionally when you go into a driving down into a low-lying area, and at least it's prevalent, I know, in some of the states in the east, when it says fog area. Maybe that's what it means. We should start posting snow areas or snow fog alert. Should be a new signage that will.
Yes, snow fog alert area.
The DOT can start making those signs imminently.
We have a fire chief that crashed his car into a back of a car, causing the gas tank to rupture, and moments later the car caught fire. It was reported just before 2 p.m. along a road in Brewerton. Employees not far from the scene said they heard the crash happen and a short time later heard the explosion. They could see smoke and flames erupt into the air. Rescue crews at the scene said that the car had its directional light on and was waiting to turn into a parking lot when it was rear-ended by the fire chief's SUV being driven by the fire chief. There were minor injuries due to the airbag deployment, and the mother and daughter who were in the car were also transported with minor injuries. In the city of Chicago, a fire engine was struck by a drunk driver. One person died and three others were injured, including a Chicago firefighter, following two separate accidents on the inbound Dan Ryan Expressway. CFD engine 122 responding to a rollover crash with multiple ejections. And while on scene, as the engine was positioned to block, the engine was struck by a drunk driver attempting to exit the expressway. The DUI driver was taken into police custody and failed a police sobriety field test. At least two people were ejected from the initial rollover crash, and one person was actually pinned in the vehicle. The injured victims from the rollover crash were transported all in critical condition. And then, of course, we have what I would consider the wreck of the month, if not perhaps even the year, occurred in the city of Houston. It happened at 10:48 a.m. Ladder company and an engine company from the Houston Fire Department responding from different stations were responding to a report of a fire in an apartment complex that actually turned out to be a good intent call, as the sewer department was checking sewer lines with smoke bombs and somebody had called in a report of that smoke. The engine and the truck were responding to this apartment fire. They were going through an intersection controlled by preemption. And to make it extremely clear to all our listeners, an intersection controlled by preemption is one in which fire trucks can grab the light. So if you're coming from different directions, one truck east, the other truck north, and the east truck grabs the signal first, the light is then going to cycle and turn green for that truck. So knowing that the intersection is equipped with preemption, and if the preemption is working properly, which it almost always is, then if you come to an intersection with a red light in a fire truck, with that intersection being equipped with preemption, you need to stop more than any other intersection on the face of the earth, because another fire truck has grabbed the signal from a different direction. In any case, according to the Houston Police Department, it was determined that the driver of the ladder truck ran that red light. The engine T-boned the ladder truck. It took out a utility pole and cut power off to several thousand people. The ladder truck then rolled onto the driver's side, and it rolled onto a car. And as I watched the video from a Houston TV station, and they were lifting the ladder truck off the car, I was aghast to find out that underneath the ladder truck was also a bicyclist. And it was a young woman who was driving her bike, and she was on her way to work. She was severely injured and died several days later in a local hospital. The driver of the car that the ladder truck rolled onto, she was less injured, and she actually crawled out through the back of the car and got out and extricated herself. There were eight Houston firefighters involved in the crash, and they were all hurt. As part of an update to that, The driver of the ladder truck has now been charged in this crash. It's just very, very sad, very tragic. And it reminds me of an article that I wrote in Firehouse Magazine many years ago. And it was titled that Nobody Wins. When you get in an incident like this, whether you're the civilian bicyclist, whether you're the fire truck driver or a member of the fire department, or whether you're a pedestrian or a driver of a car, nobody wins here. Absolutely nobody wins. A brother firefighter has to live with this for the rest of his life, along with whatever else is coming. Certainly, the driver of the car has already contacted an attorney, and the attorney has been speaking for her. And then, of course, Miss Lee Boone, 29, the bicyclist, who died, and the unbelievable tragedy and loss that her family is feeling. And so our thoughts and prayers from Mike and Tom go out to all those affected in just this horrendous, horrendous wreck. Any comments, Tom?
Mike, the only thing I can think about is when you mentioned just, and it's probably because of the geographic location, but it throws me back to the most recent occasion, January of this year, when you and I were down at the FDSOA conference, when Attorney Jim Juneau spoke and had his 10 commandments of apparatus operation and firefighter safety. And I don't remember what number it was. It's really immaterial. But one of it is, you know, thou shalt not go through red signal traffic control intersections under any condition. And you look at this, it's, yeah, you're right. Just absolutely nobody wins. You have to take the heartfelt loss for the family, for the people that were fatally injured, the injuries sustained by the people in the car. You have the now have to deal with whatever the attitudes and or attendant morale issues are within the fire department between the members of that crew, how the drivers of those two vehicles feel. And then you have to deal with at the fire department administrative level, not only being able to answer to whoever your boss is, if you're the fire chief, as to how the heck this happened. That's a pretty tough one to explain away. You then have to deal with the public perception, and in this case, certainly probably a less than pleasurable perception as to how the department is now looked at. You know, whether the people's perceptions are real or indifferent regarding the fire department, but when the perception is fire trucks are racing to the scene, that might be a common colloquial term that was used back in the day in the print media, but that's not the kind of thing that I think that we want to have the public perception to be. The fact that we are back at the station doing whatever we're doing, all right, and then when we get an alarm, we go hell-bent for election, and it's whatever it takes to get there and get there as fast as we can. Again, I don't know how many more of these incidents we're going to need to have as lessons learned. If I go back, Mike, to your employer at FDNY, that I think one of the first things that I said to you many years ago when we first met was that I had subscribed to WNYF magazine since I was in grammar school. And when they would write an article in there about an incident, yeah, they maybe had the FDNY spin, but at the end of any of those articles where they were doing a synopsis of the fire, they would do two things at the end. They would do lessons learned. It's like something that presented itself from this case that, hey, we've learned something here, and here's what we need to do so this doesn't happen again. And the second thing was lessons reinforced. There may have been an SOP, SOG, there was one of the training bulletins that come out that said, based on, for example, order of arrival, the second due ladder company does this, and here was a case where that's what the second due company did, and while you might personally not agree with what the SOP or SOG says, it reinforces this is why we do it. And there was just a session that I attended a couple of days ago, where we talked about the different generations of firefighters, and the younger generation of firefighters will inquisitively ask, well, why do we do this? Or why do we have to do this? It's written, this is the policy or the regulation. Do we really need to do this, Chief? They just don't take the policy at face value. Why do we need to do this? And they're questioning that. Well, if you look at it in the fire service, many of the policies we have is because we did something pretty serious to screw up before. Most of us weren't bright enough just one day to sit down, and I was communicating with somebody from Maryland the other day and asked for a copy of one of the general orders from a county with respect to the order of arrival of apparatus and who on the general order was who was supposed to do what. And while there might be companies that don't agree with that or say, geez, we don't want to be the second arriving special service because now we know we get stuck with RIT. Well, why is that? It's because probably at some point in time you needed to do that, and that's why somebody's written it down so that everybody understands what the rules of engagement are. So they're not up for public debate. We can talk behind the scenes as to what we need to do to improve them, but most people just don't sit down and on their day off, right, come up with 237 general orders out of their head for stuff that they just started putting pen to paper. A lot of this stuff becomes, we did something a little serious, or in some cases really serious, and screwed up, all right? You have to think, in the poor case of the Houston Fire Department, you'd think the next time, you know, if they had an SOG with respect to when you come to one of those signal-controlled intersections, if you have the red, that means stop. I'll bet they'll be in reinforcing that one, you know, in future things. And it's just, again, it goes beyond tragic. You know, I just sometimes at a loss of words what to say. If your department doesn't have these regulations, where for our listeners, irrespective of what your age is, if you read these things, you're kind of entitled to your opinion, but we're part of a greater good for the organization. If the SOP or SOG states this is what you do, it's frankly not up for debate. And I guess we'd say for Mike and Tom, if you'd like to get some further amplification on the seriousness of what you do when you violate one of those, you need to go back to listen to our good friend Billy Goldfeder in his description of what you do in cases when somebody violates them. You know, what the difference is between getting near a venial sin, what a venial sin is, and what a mortal sin is, that now you are in mortal danger. And we probably need to heighten our awareness of that, Mike, because I don't think we're certainly not getting the message by just reading the morning news every day and say, here's the crash of the day. We don't seem to be learning from our mistakes. So whether it's lessons learned or lessons reinforced, I think it's time that we begin to apply those practices. And you could be 3,000 miles away from Houston, Texas, but if you take away the learning lessons of what happened in Houston, I think it's pretty damn important that you start picking up on that.
Well, and another parallel to that, as we enter the show season and go to any number of fire truck shows, and I marvel at the warning labels, particularly on aerial devices, and each one of those warning labels probably at one point in time was a lawsuit. And you talk about a very costly lesson now that somebody has had to learn. And the other point to be made here is that a deputy chief in Houston was kind of dogged by the local press. And he came up, he was questioned about units racing into the scene trying to beat each other in. And I penned an article that will appear in the May issue of Firehouse Magazine about these apparatus-on-apparatus crashes. If we go back in the last 6 months, we've had St. Louis, New York, again, Houston, Philadelphia, and there were a couple more that I can't recall right at the moment that we highlight in that article. And we talk about this little understood, little known, and often not discussed topic of trying to beat each other in to see who's going to be first due. And the last couple here, Virginia firefighters charged with failure to wear a seatbelt in a crash. Two firefighters in Spotsylvania County were charged after an early morning apparatus crash sent them to the hospital with injuries. They were responding to a house fire. The truck crossed the road's double yellow line and crashed into an embankment. The truck's driver was charged with failure to maintain control of his vehicle and failure to wear his seatbelt, and the front seat passenger was also charged with failure to wear his seatbelt as well. And they were treated and released. Also in Pennsylvania, another apparatus crash at an intersection involved a fire company in Lewistown, and it collided at an intersection with an automobile. It looks like from the picture, a head-on kind of deal. Police said emergency lights and audible signals were activated on the truck. Several people were hurt. It doesn't appear that there were any life-threatening injuries. And then lastly, again, to go to the website, emergencyvehiclerespondse.com, we have two accidents from overseas. One was in Austria, where a fire truck responding with nine firefighters was on this extremely narrow road, and the road gave way, and they rolled multiple times down about a 90-foot embankment, and there's pictures on the website. And also in Germany, a ladder truck got in a horrendous crash that killed two civilians and a firefighter, and there's also pictures and story there. Tom, you have some apparatus industry news for us.
Yeah, Mike, we're going to talk about that. We're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk a little bit about the recent announcement made by American LaFrance. And this is Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur. We'll be back in just a minute.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects on Radio at firehouse.com. If you do have any questions for hosts Tom Shand, Michael Wilbur, please send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Gentlemen, let's get into the second half of the show. I know we have some breaking news and some other items of interest. So,
thanks, Pete. Earlier this week, American LaFrance, headquartered in Somerville, South Carolina, made an announcement that they were going to be closing their facilities in Hamburg, New York, and Ephrata, Pennsylvania, no later than the end of May, and would be consolidating operations at the Somerville plant in the near future. So for our listeners, a little background here. The Hamburg, New York plant is located up in the western part of the state, just south of the city of Buffalo. And to folks in the East Coast, the name might be ring more familiar, was formerly known and operated as R.D. Murray Fire Apparatus. The facility in Ephrata, Pennsylvania, is just outside of Lancaster, and was more famously known as the LTI, or the aerial plant, for a number of years. Now, what makes this announcement a little curious to me is that a little over a year ago, American LaFrance made an announcement that the Somerville facility was going to be used exclusively for the production of fire chassis, and also produced by American LaFrance, which was formerly a Freightliner product, is the Condor, which is the two-door tilt cab chassis that's used in refuse operation and for the pump concrete mixers, among some other vocations in the commercial truck market. And that they were going to be shifting the building of bodies and hence the completed fire apparatus up to the Ephrata facility, where they would continue to specialize in doing aerials of different descriptions, some pumpers, and the R.D. Murray facility would be used to build the pumpers and rescues and some of the specialized equipment up there. So this is almost like a 180-degree reversal of what was been going on. Now, in addition, you throw into the fact, as most of our listeners know, during 2008, American LaFrance declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings. They were working through those issues, and there's apparently a number of independent fire departments, municipalities, cities of different sizes that have units on order with American LaFrance that have been patiently waiting for those to come through. So with the closing down of the aerial facility in Ephrata and the body facility in Hamburg, New York, it once again appears that American LaFrance has changed their strategy, and they're now going to attempt to build complete fire trucks again in the Somerville, South Carolina facility. So in a nutshell, that's what's going to be happening in the future. Suffice to say, there hasn't been enough time expended since this announcement was made, you know, within the last 72 to 96 hours to see how this is actually going to play out.
But, Brother Tom, I have an American LaFrance fire truck on order, and I'm the chief, or I'm the chairman of the truck committee, or I'm the city manager. What do I do?
Well, I guess it's the very good question, Mike, but a couple of different takes on this. I guess it would depend initially, A, whether you have a performance bond to back up and guarantee the contract or not. So let's take that two ways. Let's assume for the moment you've had a unit on order in good faith from American LaFrance, and it doesn't have a performance bond. Now, again, this is just my opinion. This is not a...
Let's explain to our listeners, perhaps some new folks, what is a performance bond and what does it do?
Well, performance bond is basically a surety bond that guarantees... And it's put up by a company. It's no different than if you own a house and you say, well, I have insurance on my house. Well, some independent separate company, it could be Allstate or State Farm or any number of insurance companies out there, they underwrite the insurance on your property. You pay a premium for that, and there are stipulations within the coverage as to what they're going to cover and what they're not going to cover. A performance bond in a roundhouse fashion, Michael, is the same way in that there is a cost associated with that. The manufacturer has a business relationship with a bonding company that has looked at the financial stability of the company, has looked at a whole bunch of other criteria, and they underwrite the cost of that performance bond, which means if for some reason the manufacturing company defaults on the contract. In other words, they fail to provide the apparatus in accordance with the specifications that were tendered at the time of the bid and what the contract was written around, that the bonding company will back up that contract and see that the vehicle is completed. If that manufacturer defaults and the unit's partially completed, they'll take it and have it completed at another builder of their choice. Or if nothing had happened at all and you're waiting for the unit to be built, they'll go find an apparatus builder of their choice that is going to build it for the original agreed-to contract price. And if they can't find a builder that would build it for what the original contract was for, then it's the bonding company's responsibility basically to pony up the additional monies to make up the difference there. So there's a quick little definition on the bond. If your community has a rig on order and doesn't have a performance bond, again, my opinion only, you're almost like in a no-fault position there. You're free to walk away from the contract. You'd have to have your attorney contact the American LaFrance's attorney. And if, for example, that they quoted a 9 or 10 month delivery and you've been waiting 14 or 15 months, you're certainly free to just say, you know, we're going to cancel the contract and we're going to pack up and walk away. Now, from a timing standpoint, understand that if you choose to do that and you do not wish to wait any longer for your fire truck or your considered what might happen, the fact that you thought the unit was going to be built in Ephrata or up in Hamburg, New York, and now it's going to be done in South Carolina, and what the vehicle may actually end up looking like in that case, well, you're certainly free to ask those questions, you know, and to get some degree of written assurance in terms of a timetable and how the unit's going to be completed and how they plan on moving forth. Because certainly the unit's going to be delayed. If they're moving some of the machinery and the processes from Pennsylvania, New York down to South Carolina, they're not going to close on a Friday at one facility and be up running, you know, and building your vehicle, you know, the following Monday. I don't know what that delay or lag time is going to be, but suffice to say there'll be a lag time in there. From a timing standpoint, understand that if you signed the contract, and arguably you probably signed it prior to January 1st of 2009, understand that if you go out and take the exact vehicle that you had anticipated on buying and go put it out to rebid, all right, and say this is, you know, the design was fine, we just need to find another vendor, understand that the price is going to be greater than what that contract was that you had with America LaFrance for two very valid reasons. One is that prices, certainly, as we've talked about in earlier podcasts, have gone up predominantly because of increased raw material and manufacturing costs. And then you have the impact of the new 2009 NFPA standard, and whether it's a custom or commercial chassis, that's going to have additive cost of somewhere between $8,000 to $10,000, maybe as much as $12,000. So understand that if your finances are rigid or tight to the fact that the amount of money that you have to spend has not grown or increased from what you signed the original contract for, canceling that contract from a financial perspective may not be in your best interest, because understand you're going to pay more money. You know, I doubt you're going to find any vendor that would agree to build it. If you signed this contract, for example, in January of 2008, we're in the month of April of 2009, nobody in their right mind 15 months later is going to build it for the same price and absorb, you know, all those other additive costs that we just discussed. So I say that's no fault, because you could potentially walk away from a contract and not have any penalty, as long as there's no little legal binder or some little wrinkle in there that may have been specific to your job. Now, if you have a performance bond, that paints a little bit of a different picture. The performance bond assures that at some point in time, you're going to get a fire truck. You may lose some control if eventually, and it's too early for Mike or Tom to forecast what's going to happen with the consolidation of America LaFrance's operations back down in the Somerville. But if you're willing to wait and patient enough to wait, maybe that's one strategy. But that strategy is only effective if you can get some degree of assurance as to what the timetable is going to be, as to when the vehicle is going to be built, and to ensure yourself and your department, and more importantly, your community, municipality, this rig's going to protect, that the rig's going to be built in accordance with the specifications, and you're not going to find yourself shortchanged somewhere along the line. And that is a very important criteria, but obviously pretty difficult to be able to nail down, particularly this early into the process. So I think for those people that are willing to wait, if you have a performance bond, you know, you probably need to have your legal arm of your organization, whoever that happens to be, to make some contact with the folks through America LaFrance and get some written assurance as to what the prospects are for you to proceed to go get your apparatus, whatever it happens to be on order. If you do not get that assurance, then I think you need to exercise the first option that we talked about of consider canceling the contract. And again, we can't tell you individually what to do, whether you have with the bonding may state, but it might be discretion might be the better part of valor here, and particularly in the case of a very complex unit or a piece of aerial apparatus. If you can't get assurance as to a time frame as to when it's going to be done and to where it's going to be completed, it might be time to carefully reassess and reevaluate your situation at that point.
Thank you. A lot to take in, Brother Tom, and absorb and digest. We just can't overstate it enough. If you are going to buy apparatus, you need to have three pieces of paper submitted with each bid proposal before you sign contracts, and that is a Dun & Bradstreet to check out the financial prospectus and financial footing of the manufacturer that you're going to do business with, and you need both a performance bond and a bid bond from that company before you proceed onward, particularly with the state of the national economy and finances being what they are.
You know, one other thing on this, Mike. I mean, if your department has made some type of prepayment on the unit or paid for the chassis, if it happens to be a commercial chassis unit, or if you're in a situation where there was a trade-in involved and the manufacturer is already has taken that physical possession of that unit and you no longer have it, then a lot of what we just said kind of goes out the window. Now you need to get the sage advice of your legal counsel and find out what kind of position you're in. Those comments that we made just previous were assuming that there was the transaction, that there no monies had exchanged place, and that there was no exchange of possession of a used unit. I know there are some departments out there that had rigs in trade, and that they had already been taken and to be resold as part of the consummation of the contract requirements. And if that's the case, you're in a very different position. In that case, you need to find a good lawyer if you don't have one, and need to get somebody to be able to plead your case and sort out and at that point figure out what you're doing. You know, if you don't have a good lawyer, you need to find somebody with the temperance of like Jack McCoy on Law and Order, that he wins more than he loses. That's the kind of guy you want to go after. You don't want to introduce yourself to some lawyer if he specializes in some other private practice and works in matrimonial, you know, area. That's not the kind of guy you want to have go to bat for you on this. So before we launch into the next thing, we just want to cover one thing that Mike had come across. Again, we're not intimating any negative comments with respect to the brands that are involved here, but we were made aware of during the last couple of weeks that there's a department that had a new Mack granite model chassis that was being used for a tanker application, and they were having some issues with the chassis with regeneration of the diesel with respect to the diesel particulate filter, and you could fill in a blank here, eliminate the name Mack, and throw in a couple of other brands as well of some of the stories that we're hearing out there. But at least in this particular case, what was happening was that when the unit went into regeneration mode, when the fire pump was engaged, if it happened to just for whatever reason go into regen, and normally from what little bit that I've been made aware of it, is that there's supposed to be lockouts, electronic lockouts, so that if you are in a pumping mode, the unit cannot go into regeneration. But in this particular case, at least it was reported from a couple sources, that the unit would inexplicably go into a regen mode and would kick the pump out of gear. So it's just like the reverse of what was supposed to happen. If the pump's in gear, there's supposed to be electronic lockouts that would prohibit the engine from going into a regen mode. In this case, when the pump was engaged, for whatever inexplicable reason, if the engine would go into regen, it would actually kick the pump out, which is obviously a very unsafe situation and not what you'd want to have happen. So again, not that we're casting any negative aspersions upon the Mack product or the bodybuilder that was involved in this situation, but suffice to say, you know, here's a situation where technology has once again come to kind of bite us on the backside here. What was purported and proposed to be pretty bulletproof and trouble-free with the 2007 engines and how they were tested by the different engine people, marrying up the different brands in the various chassis and tested over the road and tested, you know, in these different test tracks and stuff for periods of several hundred thousand miles. Well, that was all good stuff and momentarily made us feel like real warm and fuzzy, like we're all going over to grandma's to have Sunday dinner. Well, then lo and behold, what we find out is that, not to our surprise, because we in the fire service, as we've spoken before, represent such a small portion of the automotive, the Class 7 and Class 8 truck market, that we didn't get an opportunity to test any of this stuff on fire trucks until we started building them. So what we find out is that there are several unfortunate circumstances, more than just we related on this one particular incident, where the fire service, unfortunately, frankly, becomes the guinea pig. Every time you marry a combination that hasn't been done before, we don't have the financial resources to take every possible commercial chassis and engine combination, package it together with the fire body, and then go test it to see if all this stuff works the way it's purported to work. And when it doesn't work, it just becomes very, very aggravating. And it's kind of like, in some cases, because neither Mike or I tend to be very computer savvy, it's like you're having a great day until something hangs up in your computer and you can't solve it. And then you realize that we have now become a nation where, and particularly important here in the fire service, where there's so many electronic things that we need to get trained on, and our mechanics need to be appropriately reviewed and trained as to how to diagnose these issues, that we're finding out a lot of times when there's an incident, either at a training scenario or a fire scenario at the scene of an emergency, and something malfunctions on the unit, you then bring the unit into your fire department shops or to the local repair shop and say, hey, this happened. And a guy looks at you with this strange look like, nah, that can't happen. Yeah, well, we know it can't happen, but something went afoul, and here's the scenario, and here's what went on, and it's virtually impossible to try to duplicate until it happens again. And then you run around and you chase a similar, you know, or slightly similar situation again. So to the folks out there, if you want to make sure that if you're taking delivery of new apparatus that has 2007 EPA-compliant engines, that you thoroughly test and train with those in the different scenarios. Make sure you clearly understand the operating parameters of that, and you just don't read it out of a book. You actually want to go do this stuff, so you find out that if you have to take some, as we would call it, maybe evasive action on the fire ground to make sure that everything is operating properly, that you don't get surprised and then find out that you've got a scenario or you've got an untrained engineer, chauffeur, operator with the unit, and something gets thrown at him and he's not able to be able to do this, which, Mike, I guess goes to some of the things that you've been talking about with talking about simulation. It's great to have driving simulators and simulators that we can train incident commanders and our company officers how to operate on a fire ground. But it's pretty tough to simulate some of these apparatus incidents that we've been made aware of to say, okay, you're now operating at the scene of a fire and, you know, the engine shuts down. What do you do? You know, you need to think about those things before they occur.
I remember in good pump operator schools, they used to throw all that kind of stuff at you. They'd open a drain and have you try to draft and a lot of other things, and you would have to diagnose the problem and try and get water. And like you alluded to, it's much different now, and it's much more difficult to do when we've entered into this world of just heavy electronics. And you know, when you talk to manufacturers and technicians, and sometimes they're even at a loss to figure out exactly what's going on. And it just seems to me, as we leave the 2007 engine emission change and now enter into the new world of the 2010 engine emission change, that problems and like that you just reviewed are going to become more numerous and potentially more difficult to solve.
So I think it goes without saying, much as we had talked about with the our extensive rundown in the first segment of the program today, talking about the recent incidents and accidents and the heightened awareness of what we need to do with training, we need to have our training commensurate with the level of technology that we're throwing at people. I don't know how many departments that I've been in, and if you're looking at their array of apparatus, and if the oldest unit in the fleet now that we're, you know, somebody said I have a 1986 pumper, probably based on my age, I'm still thinking that's not too old. Then you start putting things in perspective and go, well, that's a 22-year-old, 23-year-old rig. It's how many versions back of NFPA 1901, probably completely unsafe in a lot of different aspects, even if it's been partially rehabbed. But generally, you'll find that the older units people have an affinity for because they were less complex, more things that were mechanical, more things that there was a cable, a rod, something positive from point A to point B to make something operate. And when it didn't operate, it was pretty darn easy to figure out why it wasn't operating and overcome it. When you have some of these issues on a fire ground now with all the electronics, and it's a great day being the chauffeur of the unit pumping at a major alarm fire, to the first time you realize your governor's not working, and what do you do then? And I think a lot of departments, we've just trained too many of our people that it's a plug-and-play type operation. You push this button, you do this, and everything works. And, well, what do you do the day it doesn't work? And a lot of people haven't even been exposed to that. And then we expect them to perform and do these, you know, heroic, if not extraordinary, moves on a fire ground. I guess the best parallel I can think about is You think about how an NFL team prepares for their opponent during every Sunday with a playbook with scripted plays. We in the fire service rely on our SOPs or SOGs to tell us what to do, assuming this thing gets thrown at you. There's not too many departments that I've seen that really spend a lot of time in this area. And again, as we're now, we're not just surrounded by electronics, we're overwhelmed by electronics. And as much as I might like to turn the clock back 23 years and say, let's bring back the mechanical engines, we all know that's not happening. So, which then leads us into our next little brief segment we're going to talk about is this little bit further discussion on what we covered in the April issue of Firehouse Magazine, where we talked about program pumpers. And this might be something to consider for a department if you find yourself, you're in the American LaFrance situation and you're in a thing where you desperately need a rig. All right, and you can't wait. They come back and they tell you it's going to be another 9 months, and you don't have 9 months left in that vehicle that you're attempting to replace. Or it could be for a department that recently has received an AFG grant or one of the other grants that are out there and have a more immediate need for an apparatus, or maybe don't have, no disrespect to people, but maybe just don't have the time and talent to go through. If you look at the first five or six articles that we wrote back in the Apparatus Architect when we first started, Mike, and started talking about the process with the truck committee and evaluating, you know, analyzing your needs and evaluating manufacturers and going to, you know, going to shows and go visit factories and go through the specification process, maybe your department doesn't have the time or internally have the talent to do that, to spend the next 9 or 10 months surveying the situation that you find yourself having immediate need for an apparatus. And there is a program unit which have pre-engineered pieces, parts that can be configured to build something for your community that arguably you may be able to get within a 3 month, 4 month, 5, 6 month period without having to, as they, I guess in the old school would say, reinventing the wheel. That might be something to write up your alley. The particular unit that we featured in our article at the South End Fire Company in Winchester, Virginia, to me was just a very dramatic example of how it can work in a community where that particular station had previously always purchased fully custom apparatus that they had specified down to every little item that they wanted because of the economy and how that department runs partially on some municipal funding and still does fundraising. They run weekly bingo. They just did not have the funds to go buy that fully customized unit. So they got a unit that was still met everything that they wanted to do. You can go in and read the article and see it still had a fair number of the items that most departments would want to put on there. It had a lot of the safety items that Mike and I have harped on regarding the reinforced bumper and the proper mounting of tools, both within the cab and in the compartments. It wasn't that they took this thing and just threw stuff at it.
Had a custom cab.
Right, had a custom cab. I mean, it was a very well thought out, well designed unit. And when the individual was taking me around a unit and, you know, really told me this is a program unit, it really just kind of took me back, because the initial thing visually you look at it says this was a fully custom rig. And again, that's a moderate to high end example, but you can take that there's a number of manufacturers that have program type units that either have them in some cases if a department wrecks a unit. I mean, Lord knows, look at some of the incidents that Mike has had. You may be operating, if you're the Houston Fire Department and had that very tragic apparatus accident, a department as large as that has spare pumpers and spare ladder trucks. Those guys were riding in something the very next day because you can't afford to close the fire station. If you're in a combination department or an all-volunteer department and you're operating two engines, a tanker and a brush unit, and the tanker gets involved in an accident or one of the engine gets involved in an accident, chances are you don't have a spare unit, all right? And after you get through the initial hurdle of having to get through the accident scenario and the accident analysis, who's going to lay blame? You get the insurance company involved. You get an insurance settlement. You're very well, particularly if you're in a rural area and there's a great distance in between stations, you may not have the luxury of saying, okay, let's appoint Chuck Buddy and Terry to the apparatus committee, and we're going to give them 6 months, and then 8 months after that, we'll have a new fire truck here. You may find yourself having to get something and get it right quick.
Yeah, but to make a point to that, Tom, some departments tend to panic after that happens, and they try to do do some crazy things. One of the things that I feel strongly about is buying like demo units, just to say that you have a truck. You're going to have this truck for potentially 20 or 25 or even maybe 30 years, and to buy a unit that's not going to be necessarily very well suited for your first due area, just to say that you got a truck and replaced it and spent the insurance money or whatever, is foolhardy at best. There's other options that you can do, again, such as a program truck that could be delivered with meeting more of your specifications and say a demo. And of course, the difference being is that a demonstrator truck is already built today and it's been driven around the country to different shows and been shown and seen and probably has a lot of features on it, but maybe not necessarily the ones that your first due area needs versus a program truck that you can specify some of those much needed options that it's going to make it more user friendly and more doable for your first due area. Another thing that could potentially happen that you could do after a wreck is to buy a fairly good used vehicle until you can go through the process to get a new vehicle. That process, it takes a year or maybe 18 months from the time that you conceptualize a unit until it's actually bid, sign contracts, pre-con, up to final delivery. That may be an option as well, or even just putting a neighbor on AutoAid to send a unit would be much better than hitting the panic button in that case and just going and buying the first thing that flies through the door.
Yeah, the point well taken there, Mike. We differentiated in the article the difference between a demo unit and a program unit, and our thoughts being that the program units can fill a niche in the market that maybe in the past, even without the financial constraints that we find ourselves in a lot of communities in, that people just kind of turn their nose up on it, with the inference being, oh, that's, they couldn't possibly build what I want out of that unit. And part of that is that when program units first came into play 10, 12 years ago, some of the major builders were doing program units as the low end, as the entry level. In other words, you can't buy a fire truck with six tires cheaper than this. And that's where the whole system kind of started. Most manufacturers now have evolved that program unit is available in both a custom and commercial configuration. The pump enclosure and a body is identical, whether it's on one chassis or the other. And if you're in a department that has, for example, you're still responding the majority of your people from home, and then there's no need to go buy that demo unit that's got a six-person cab with a raised roof, because you're never going to put six people in it,
right?
Probably ever in your history, all right? So there, the two-person or three-person cab with the 330-horse or 350-horse engine and automatic transmission just do absolutely superb for you. On the other hand, if you're operating in this scenario, you're operating in a small little village or town, and you have a large rural area that you protect under contract, and everything else in your fleet has got a 1,000-gallon water tank, when the guy shows up with the demo pumper, and the typical demo pumper today is a 1250 or 1500 pump, 750-gallon water tank, ladders enclosed somewhere, and double high side body with roll-up doors. Well, if that doesn't fit your needs, if you can't put your equipment in that body, if everything else you need 1,000 gallons of water, then buying that rig, because it backed up on your ramp, to give you an idea as to what the department's what the manufacturer's capabilities were, rather, and to have to sacrifice the 250 gallons of water, that's not a good deal.
That's a deal breaker there. That absolutely is.
Then you go back to the original things we talked about. You got to establish what do you need on that vehicle, and do that before you start kicking tires.
And we call that define the mission of the vehicle.
Right. Because
what is it going to be?
Because if you find yourself, just saying, well, let's look at what demo units people have. You want to be looking at in terms of what the the manufacturer's capabilities are, look at the methods of construction, find out if they meet what you're looking for in terms of body material and how it's put together. You want to be talking to the salesperson and assess where this guy is, where his service capabilities are. You don't necessarily be looking at that. I guess the best parallel would be if you're in the market for a new car and you walk into a car dealer and you identify yourself and you've identified a basic make and model, all right, and they ask you to take a test drive in that. The unit that they're asking to take a test drive may or may not have the options on it. Probably it's not the color you want. Not too many people go in and test drive a car and go, I'm going to go buy that car, you know. Many dealerships, if you wonder why they have certain colors of cars on a lot, is because they know what the most popular colors are to be attractive to people, and they may try to sell you something that has a package on it that you don't want. Well, it's the same thing with the demo unit. If it's got some foam system on it that's neat and cool, but you don't have, you know, you have minimal foam capabilities in your thing department, there's not a whole lot of sense in buying a demo unit that's got a $12,000 foam system on it just for the sake of saying, okay, we bought it today, you know. And again, manufacturers are attuned enough to know what sells most easily, so they build these demo units so they show well, that they're attractive, and that may be right up your department's alley, and it may not. You know, if they show up with a double high side rig with a hydraulic ladder rack, and you're in the middle of middle America, and you everything else you've got in your fleet is high left, low right, and you need a 35-foot ladder, then buying a rig with a ladder rack with a 24-foot ladder probably is not the smartest thing you need to do. All right. So
when we go back, we could go back full circle here, and we talk about American LaFrance's troubles and people that have orders pending with them that may potentially cancel those orders. A program truck actually may be a good remedy to that versus the high dollar cost of a fully custom American LaFrance rig versus the price point for a good truck such as the Winchester truck that we featured in the article.
Right. I mean, the things you're going to sacrifice very, very little. The big thing that most of the, and I don't consider this a sacrifice, but for some departments, this is a huge hurdle to get them over. In fact, that was one of the questions that came in from one of our listeners who wanted to know what we saw the advantages of the small, quote, small block 2007 diesel engine, say up to 400, 425 horsepower versus a department that historically has always said, what's the biggest thing they make? Oh, 500, 515, 535, whatever it is, and that's what we're going to put in there. One of the attendant dollar savings in the program unit is that the smaller block diesel engine, and when you say small in the fire service, we take aversion to that immediately, is that these units typically start with horsepower down around 300 to 330 horsepower, which if your department has a whole fleet of commercial chassis units, or the rig you're replacing is a C-Series Ford, even in the day if it had a Cat 3208 in it, it was 225 horsepower. So don't look down at your nose at 330 saying, oh my God, that's not going to get out of our way. On the other hand, if your department has always had big block engines, you need to drive these things to see the performance. And when you do an engine scan, to go to our question of the week here, is that you find out that the cost differential between that big block engine, no matter what brand you're talking about, and a 4000 series Allison transmission versus an engine in the 400 to 425 horsepower range, which is generally where these program units max out, all right, with the 3000 series transmission, there's anywhere between $8,000 to $12,000 cost difference just in the engine and tranny.
Right, and we're not talking about now that bigger engine and tranny can't fit in that particular chassis, and so now we have to upgrade the front axle. We have
right.
to upgrade, and all of a sudden it's not $20,000 or $30,000 anymore. And that's where the
exactly.
cost.
That's just in the engine and transmission. You're absolutely right, Mike. Because a big block engine, if you put it in an 8-person cab, all right, and now with the NFPA regulations to 2009, that you have to allow 250 pounds for every seat in the cab, it's not uncommon to find these units have 21,500, 22,000-pound front axles under them, all right? Well, there again, the small block engine versus the big block engine, there's horsepower trade-offs. There's weight trade-offs, too. Those small block engines can run anywhere from 600 to upwards of 1,100 pounds lighter in weight. So you don't need a 22,000-pound front axle. You don't need the big springs. You don't need 425 tires. You can run around, in a lot of these cases, with an 18,000-pound axle in a six-person cab with 315 tires, which will still give you the rating. And by the way, now that that's on a 9-inch rim, you got a better cramp angle and better turning radius. So our old adage of bigger is better. Again, the people say, I want the biggest horsepower engine, you know, and there is no warranty difference manufacturer to manufacturer within the engines or the Allison folks between a 3000 and a 4000 series transmission. Still, the warranties are the same. So some people think, you know, I'm buying small stuff, so there's you got to be cheating me somewhere. Now, again, if you're running this engine, you know, this is not necessarily meant to be in a city where you're going to run this thing down a road 3,500 times a year and your replacements and your life cycle for that rig's got to be 15 years. That's maybe not the best application here. But if we're talking about the bread and butter fire department that Mike and I have seen, and these people, the life expectancy of this rig is going to be 20 to 25 years, and they're running a couple hundred calls a year, and we've seen 20-year-old rigs, one of the places you just went to, Mike, had a 22-year-old pumper and had 18,000 miles on it. Well, again, they're not running the wheels off this thing, right? We're not even on, in your job. You guys do high runs, but not high mileage. When Mike and I out early this year out at Firehouse World in San Diego, spent some time with Chief Kevin Esther, I think he told me that their average engine was somewhere like 26 or 27,000 road miles annually. Okay, well, that's
a big deal.
You want the high horsepower. You want the heaviest components there, because in that duty cycle, it's going to pay for itself. But you pay for the listeners need to understand with the program units, and go into the question. You pay for horsepower. It doesn't come free. And then you have the engine, the transmission. You have to upgrade your drive lines. You have to upgrade at the very least your front axle, your springs, tires, wheels, suspension. It all becomes additive. So the program unit, you need to think about if from the back of the cab back, if you can get the firefighting package of that. Now, I know this is going to hurt you, Mike, but we're talking about a pumper here, okay?
Tom.
All right. We had to get that in at least once during this segment, all right? If the firefighting part of the package in that program unit can do everything that you need to do, then your sanity check is, do you want to spend another 15, 20, pick a number, 20,000 more to get that fully customized rig, to get it just the way you want? You know, if you can do with interior door panels, for example, that are made out of aluminum tread plate or in most cases polished stainless steel, rather than having wood grain overlay and as you open it saying custom built for the Michael Wilbur Fire Department, if that's what you got to have, then open, you know, break open the piggy bank and you're going to pay for it. People need to think about program units as being an alternative. You could specify the rig of your dreams, but if your community doesn't have the funds for it, you know, your alternatives are, as I see it, you get four alternatives, and we'll wrap up with this and then let Mike comment, right? If your committee maybe has identified the needs, determined the missions of the vehicle, you've evaluated the builders, and you got it narrowed down to a couple people you'd like to bid on a project, and you go through that whole process, and then you finally go link up with your financial person in town, the guy that's going to break the piggy bank or give you the Visa gold card, and he's just shaking his head and saying, Chief, sorry, no way. You know, there's no way this community can afford $485,000. You got $400 to spend. Well, what do? You got four options, right? You could do nothing, right? We in the fire service generally don't acclimate ourselves to that, just sit on our hands and do nothing, right? You could come up and try to see if there's alternative revenue sources that you could do to add to that. If you're in the situation where the community gives you X amount of money, but the fire department has some fundraising stream, you could supplement it, all right?
Grants.
Right. You could write some grants, a whole bunch of different avenues to supplement the funding, right? You could look at it and say, okay, well, instead of replacing that rig that we were thinking about dumping out, maybe we just need to put a nominal sum of money into it
to rehab it,
keep it going, get it to upgrade it to meet a certain edition of the NFPA standard. Certainly not going to be practical to do the 2009 edition, all right? Or you could look at a program unit. All right. So there's options out there. But I think for our listeners, again, depending on where you are geographically, understand it, since Michael and I are based in the East, and both of us live in a state that about the only thing you can say about our state government is they've made a lot of great fun of our governor on Saturday Night Live. The economic situation's not very bright, all right, in a lot of cases. So early on in the process, to wrap up, all right, if you're planning on buying any kind of apparatus, you want to get plugged into your financial folks early and often and have a pretty good price estimate as to where you're going to fall and make sure you got the money to do that. Because Mike and I have handled a number of individual inquiries from departments that are like crestfallen, even after they've gotten a grant, because the grant process takes time. And the way the economy's been, inflation is outpacing your ability to make money or what your money was making for you. And people are now to the point, it's okay, we're going to go bid this thing. And they just, it's like walking on a car lot thinking, you know, I've got $22,000 in, you know, in my pocket. I'm going to buy the four-door family Sportster, and everybody's laughing at you saying, you better be looking at a smart car because, that's the only thing you can afford. So you want to make sure that you, again, touch all the bases. You know, it's cool to hit the home run, but you want to make sure that as you go around that you address the needs of the community. You make sure you're sensitive, if nothing else, particularly if you're in a case where your budget is under public scrutiny. You want to be spending the taxpayers' dollars wisely and not just buying the high horsepower monument so you can put, you know, the Mike Wilbur bronze plaque on there that, you know, after Mike Wilbur goes on and, you know, decides to become an engine officer at some point.
Oh, God forbid.
Well, hey, you know, stranger things could happen here, brother, you know. Can't be on a truck for your whole life. So at any rate, appreciate our listeners for this month. Again, any people that have questions, please send them in to the website, and we'll be happy to address them on the air. Michael, any final parting thoughts?
Yeah, I think we had a good show. I hope we've been able to help our listeners, particularly with American LaFrance products on order, and the idea of fully explaining what a program truck can be and can do for you. And, you know, to reiterate, Tom, it's just really important to find out how much you spend, have to spend, because ultimately you're wasting the salesman's time and efforts. And you're just trying to fool yourself. If you have only X amount of dollars to spend, then that's the benchmark, and that's what you have to start out with and try to design a truck around that price point.
Very good, Mike. Well, listen, wrapping up here, this is Tom Shand.
And Mike Wilbur.
All right, the Apparatus Architects, thanks very much, and we look forward to seeing you out on the road here in the next couple of weeks and to be able to catch our next podcast. Thanks very much, and stay safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.